What's up, knife freaks, sharpness geeks, and purveyors of stabby goodness? Welcome to the Knife Freak Show. My name is Jonathan McNeese, and I'm joined by my co-host, Mr. Chase Boatwright.
Greetings from beyond.
Somebody's getting ready for Halloween.
Yeah, definitely. Always love Halloween around here.
Yeah. Speaking of, before we dive into our normal shop updates, you got anything special planned for Halloween as far as like special knife projects?
No, but I really should. I should get on that sooner rather than later, since it will be here before I know it. One year I did like an entire batch of Halloween themed knives, and I told myself I was going to do that every year. It just always seems to sneak up on me somehow.
What about you? Yes, it does. Yeah, kind of the same. We got a couple of we've tossed around some ideas. I'm not 100% sure exactly what it's going to be yet, but I definitely want to do something. But as usual, it falls at really kind of a bad time because of our show schedule. So, you know, we're going to talk about some of that coming up, but we've actually got multiple things back to back coming up here. So, we'll see. I really want to do something because that's kind of my – that or maybe like 4th of July are probably my two favorite, you know, holidays or whatever. So I'd really like to do something. Agree. So we'll see what we can come up with. I definitely do want to try to do something. I just haven't. I'm always torn because I like doing theme stuff, but at the same time, anytime you do something that's a very specific theme, it tends to narrow the market down. You know, it's not going to appeal to as many people. It's not going to be as broad of an audience. So it's kind of a, you know, you got to be careful. You know, you can do some theme stuff, but if you take it, you know, if you go too big with it, then there may not be enough of a audience for it that, you know, that won't say, you know, Freddy Krueger themed knife or whatever, which we've actually done before.
So. Yeah. That's definitely a consideration, is trying to make it on theme, but also not make it so niche that it, you know, basically wipes out your interest base. I mean, there's always...
Right.
Somebody out there will like it.
Right.
But it's a matter of finding that right person that will like it and that will also buy it and, you know, marrying those two. And that's not always the case when you get something that's, you know, sort of, you know, in an already niche product.
That's right.
Then making it further niche beyond that is sometimes complicated.
Agreed. And like for us, it's, you know, I always feel pretty confident we can do, you know, any kind of theme and probably sell, you know, at least make 5 or 10 of them and be okay. But you start getting beyond that. But then if you're not doing more than that, depending on how involved the project is, then you got to factor in whether it's actually worth taking on. If we can only do, you know, safely do 5 of them and know that there's going to be a buyers for them or whatever. So maybe try to come up with something that's, I always like to think along the lines of maybe something that's, you know, so it could be Halloween themed, but maybe it's not necessarily, doesn't have to be Halloween themed, like just kind of depending on how you look at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, and like, I was telling you about this a minute ago. Like, I just finished a knife that I felt was sort of Halloween-y in a way. It was, you know, purple scales and had a really dark acid wash. So like it's, you know, I felt like it was sort of in that dark, you know, sort of, I guess, gothic, you know, spooky looking thing, but not quite full on pumpkin with a, you know, pumpkin engraved or something on it. You know?
Right. Yeah.
So you don't want to be like hokey and stuff when you do stuff. I mean, even though there are people out there that kind of like the hokey, kitschy, you know.
Yeah. Just straight up like on the nose, like here's a screaming pumpkin or here's a Jason mask, and again, we've done some of that stuff, and it's always cool, but it definitely, you can see the market shrink when you do that for sure. So, but anyway, so yeah, we're going to plan on doing something. Hopefully you will too. I'll be interested to see what you come up with. So
me too.
Now that I've put the pressure on. So what about you? How was your week in the shop?
It was pretty good. I had limited time this week, but it was still pretty good. I got 6, 7, I don't remember. I got a batch of fixed blades done and posted a few of them for sale on Friday and sold most of them. And so felt pretty good with that. And that was a batch I'd been working on for a few weeks. And so, what about you?
Yeah, very good. Yeah, we've had a We've had a pretty good week. We mentioned it, I guess, the last podcast, but of course we had the interview last time, which we'll touch on in a minute, but we have gotten our new machine in, the new Haas. It's basically another, exactly like the ones we had, just it has a couple of fairly minor upgrades, but it's essentially the same machine we had. We just added another one to try to be able to keep up with our production schedule. And it's even with that machine, it's already like a challenge of trying to figure out how to schedule what to run, when to run it, and that kind of stuff is already proven to be a challenge. Unfortunately, it wasn't just a magical, you know, here's the new machine and now we can all of a sudden pump out plenty of parts, because I probably should have pulled the trigger on the machine at least a couple of months before I did, and probably need to pull the trigger on another one before the end of the year. So we'll see.
You're telling me there's not a magic formula for this?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, obviously another machine equals, you know, more parts being able to be run in a given amount of time, but we were already kind of so far behind or pushing it so close that just another machine, it doesn't. Part of it, honestly, is the length of time that these programs take, like especially like the handle programs is the main thing that we're dealing with. Handles for these Dixons take, I think, now we've shaved a good bit of time off of them. We've also been going back and trying to make our programs as efficient as possible and everything. And we've been able to shave, props to my machinist, Joseph. He popped in here the other day while I was talking to somebody and was like, hey, I think I just shaved like, 20 minutes or more off of my, no, it was like 50 minutes off of one handle program. Yeah. When we try to run them, the Op 2 programs, at least like two at a time. So basically, so that's double that. So I shaved off of an entire run, that's shaved, you know, the better part of 2 hours off of it. So that's a huge difference. But when you start getting into these programs that run, for example, the handle to run two, which when I say run two programs, that is only, that's still only 10 sets of parts. So 10 sets of Dixon handles, when they come off the machine, it takes, I think now we're down to somewhere around 8 hours, give or take, to run, to get 10 finished. Well, actually that's not true. It's not 10 fully finished parts, but without going in the weeds too much, this actually may be a good topic for a future episode, now that I'm thinking about it, a closer breakdown of like every step along the way. We've talked about some of it, but I think that I could talk for several minutes about all the different things. So that's the main program that puts all the features on the Op 2 side, but then they still have to have the tabs cut off of them in a separate program, which takes another to run all 10 of those 10 sets. I think it's another 2 to 3 hours, something like that. So to have, and this is all after an Op 1 program has been run. Which it doesn't take nearly as long, but it still adds time. So then you got the Op 2 and the tabs alone, you know, you're looking at least 10 hours worth of running. And so you start looking at a 24-hour day, you can only get a maximum of 20 handles off of one machine in a 24-hour day. That starts to get pretty tight. And like I said, you've still got to do the Op 1 programs. We've still got a machine that's running. We got to run clips, which take Op 1 on them is like, I want to say Op 1 is like 6 or 7 hours, and Op 2 is like 8 or 9, something like that, to get. But now when they're done, we have like 27, something like, I think like 27 clips, assuming that none of them got messed up. So it's not like that's, you know, obviously not per clip, but still, that still adds up. That's a lot of time.
Yeah.
So,
for a machine,
anyway,
you know. Yeah, like to be tied up.
Yeah, it ties the machine up, right.
Yeah.
And then that's not counting blade stuff, you know, so it's a lot. You start thinking, feeling like you've got a bunch of machines and you can get a lot done, until you start actually doing the math and it's like, oh, wow, we're still running pretty lean here.
Yeah.
So we're going to continue to try to find ways to be smarter about it and run stuff at night. I mean, make the programs more efficient where we can. we've started
sort of fine tuning
the limit. Yeah. Fine tuning, yeah. Cutting off any excess time where a tool's, you know, moving an excess amount that it doesn't need to, or anywhere we can maybe use. We found a couple of places where we were just kind of stuck in our ways of using certain size tools. And we found a couple of places where we could actually use a bigger tool that would allow us to essentially cover more ground quicker and run it a little bit harder, more aggressive, because the bigger tool is not going to break as easy. So there's probably quite a decent amount of meat left on the bone that we can still, you know, save some time. But all that being said, super happy to have the new machine in and running, and it's doing good. It's flooded the shop a couple of times already, which is pissing me off. But so
it's like getting a new puppy.
Yeah, no kidding. This so it came, the coolant on it, I'd have to go back and look at the package that I bought. I don't know if it's got an actually different cooling package or if this one just has the upgraded features just because it's newer. But this one has some coolant nozzles that are down like at the bed, like in the bottom of it, that help blow the chips and stuff towards the trough where the auger takes the chips out of there. And so it's got more coolant flow kind of coming through there. And the coolant drains out of the back of the machine and drains through it drains through a filter basket, basically. And it's, if you're not careful, in that filter basket gets a little bit backed up. And the one that came from it on the factory would get backed up almost immediately. So if you've got such a good flow of coolant coming out of the machine, it's draining into that, and it starts to, you know, it's pouring into it faster than it can drain through the filter. And so then it starts to overflow. And I bought a new, you know, fairly expensive new filter basket to replace the generic factory one. And it overflowed with it last night. So I'm not just going to have to make sure that we keep that filter basket on that one, like super cleaned out or something, because it's very sensitive to, like I said, I think it's just because we have so much more coolant flow going through the machine. It's basically creating a faster waterfall coming out of the back of the machine. And any little bit of the filter being clogged up is causing it to get backed up enough to overflow. So anyway, I've actually got to go to town when we get off of here and go buy some more oil dry so I can finish getting it put out on the coolant leak from last night.
Oh, well, Fun. It's always something.
Unfortunately, but that's, in the grand scheme of things, that's fairly minor, so we'll be all right. It is cutting parts good, so I can live with it. So we've had a good week overall. Machine's going good. We've got some projects in the works, trying to get a little better at planning ahead and stuff. We got a lot of exciting stuff coming up, so I'm really feeling real psyched out of my mind right now about what all we've got coming up. So looking forward to being able to share more stuff as we go forward. But so, speaking of being psyched out of our minds, I was pretty psyched when we got to sit down with Mr. Ernest Emerson.
That was
really cool. I feel like I've gotten several good comments on the podcast and stuff on the interview with him. So I feel like it went over pretty well. I'm sure I could have done a much better job as an interviewer. I'm going to need some practice, but
I was not much better. I was silent for most of it, but you know, I was trying not to get in the way.
I was probably not silent for enough of it. Opposite problem. So just let him give him a direction and let him talk. And we could have sat there and learned all kinds of stuff. So still did learn a lot.
Yeah. I mean, to talk a little inside baseball, I guess. I mean, it is hard to, like, you know, you're talking to someone and you're wanting to, you know, listen to everything they have to say, but also we're on a time limit when we do this sort of stuff. And so, we're sometimes having to condense the conversation to a, you know, certain place, and trying to find a place to interject in is not always the easiest thing. And sometimes, you try to do it with tact, but it's also kind of difficult to do it with tact at times.
That's right. You want to make sure we hit, you know, kind of the high points that we had outlined that we wanted to go over. And then, but at the same time, you don't want to miss out on a good nugget that may come up in conversation. So it's like, it makes it tough. But, and hats off to all these interviewers out there, you know, podcasters and different hosts, TV show hosts and stuff, that are actually good at good at that. That's definitely a skill set.
Yeah, so. For sure. But beyond that part of it, I mean, I was just, you know, I'd never really even spoken to Ernest before. Like I've seen right. him at shows, and like usually he's kind of covered up and I'm just kind of looking right. at the knives at the other end of the table. That's usually how I roll at blade shows and stuff, is there'll be a crowd over here beside the person that people want to talk to. And I'm just kind of at the end of the table looking to see what I can see and then just moving on. And cause I don't want to bother people yeah. or like, you know, I usually nowadays I don't have time to sit and wait and talk to a person
right.
that, you know, if they're tied up, I just have to kind of move on and go. And,
yeah,
but yeah, I was super excited to talk to him. I mean, that, and he was, very cool dude.
Yes.
Like yep. down to earth, yep. humble,
very much.
Just chill dude.
Yep. Absolutely. Tons of history there, tons of knowledge there, you know, done incredible things for the industry. So super, super cool to be able to sit down and talk to him. That was for sure awesome. And I of course was particularly interested in his thoughts about all the Chinese companies and that kind of stuff. So that was good to hear a like-minded thinker / business owner or whatever. So
yeah. I had a feeling it would be similar beats on that, but it was, you know, still good to hear his points that he brought up and all that.
Yeah. And
yeah,
he's been there, you know, like I said, I even kind of have, but you know, been there long enough to have seen kind of the rise of more of it, but he's been there, you know, seen even more of it than I have. So it was definitely yeah. good to hear his take on it.
For sure.
So, yeah.
With that though, we'd keep your, for you guys listening, keep your suggestions coming in on other interviews you'd want to see, or, you know, if you know you have any what's the word I'm looking for, constructive criticism on our interviewing skills or things, you know, you might want to hear from us asking the guests and stuff, please let us know.
Yeah. And we for sure, I don't know how often, it'll probably just depend on the people that we try to, you know, coordinating with the people that we want to get on here, but definitely going to try to start making that a at least semi-regular thing. I got a couple of people that I've already talked to about it. It was just a matter of getting a time lined up and stuff, that kind of thing. So we're definitely going to do more of that going forward. That was fun. I hope it was enjoyable for you guys and brought some value to you. So,
yeah.
And my goal, as I kind of said before his podcast, was my goal is maybe hit some sides of stuff that aren't just the typical interview of, you know, hey, what's your history? What's your, you know, whatever, just, you know, what are you doing right now? Whatever, like some behind the scenes on some of the stuff that we like to talk about, like the business side and marketing and different things. So, I'd really like to dig. There's a lot of people's brains that I want to dig into on some of that. So we're going to continue to try to do that.
There's one brain in particular that I'm pretty sure you've already reached out to that I'm kind of scared to get into the dark parts of that brain. But anyway,
yeah, yeah. There's some that might be a little tricky, but that's all right.
Yeah.
It
should be fun either way.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So, look for more of that, and then as far as what kind of stuff is coming up on the horizon as far as news or anything like that, I believe Blade Show West is the next big thing coming up pretty quickly.
Yes. Be here before you know it. It's October 10th and 11th, and it's in Salt Lake City, Utah. And as we've mentioned before, I will not be there, but the McNeese team will be there. I believe you and Amy are going. Is that right?
Yep, that's right. Yep, it'll just be me and her. We will be there, and hopefully have some really, really cool stuff for you, and definitely Dixon's. We're going to have some Mac 2s. Going to try to bring a decent amount of swag and stuff to this show. Traditionally we haven't brought a ton of swag and stuff to some of the shows we have to travel farther to, particularly the ones we have to fly to, but we're going to try to make that happened this year and have at least some stuff. We've got a couple of special things planned, so we'll see how that goes. But really looking forward to it. It was a really fun show last year. Great people out there. Looking forward to getting to talk to a lot of people again and meet more people. So really looking forward to it.
For sure. Wish it was closer. That's basically all my my only complaint about it is I don't do well flying, and so I just that one's a bit far for me to have to drive at this point in my life with the youngin' and all that. So
That's a lot of time out of your time out of your schedule devoted to driving. I know a couple of other makers that do drive, you know, and it's a lot. So
that's also, you know, lost work days as well, you know,
exactly
sort of stack up and, you know, I would have to leave on like Tuesday or something to get out there by, you know, or, you know, whatever.
Right.
I haven't GPSed it, but I know it's a long way away.
Yeah. I don't remember exactly how far the drive is either, but it's far enough that we're not willing to do it. I mean, we would if we had to probably, but at this point, it just makes sense for us to fly. So yeah, looking forward to that, and we will be at booth 226 there, guys, before I forget to mention that. So make sure you come see us. It's not a huge, huge show, so you shouldn't have any trouble finding us, but come see us and at the very least come shake our hand and chat a little bit.
Yeah.
So really looking forward to that.
Yeah. I hope y'all do well and hope everybody else going out there enjoys it and all that stuff.
Me too. And actually, I kind of acted like I was done with that, but it just occurred to me that I should probably mention, because the following weekend, whatever the date is that, so I'll be back at the shop on Monday, and by like Thursday, we will be leaving again to go up to Pigeon Forge, to Smoky Mountain Knife Works. And they're having a rep weekend up there, and Amy and I will be there working working behind the counter at the McNeese Knives section. So I think we've got a couple of things planned to try to take up some special stuff as we go. So anybody that's in the area up there, you know, please, by all means, that's going to be a, I'd hate to be standing behind the counter all day and not get to talk to anybody. So come see us. They may put me to work. They'll have me out there sweeping the floor if nobody's at the counter. So you guys come on and keep me from having to sweep the floor.
Put you in the Stevie section.
That would go over real well. real well. I figure I'd get about 2 minutes before I'd be kicked out of there. So
probably, yeah.
Maybe that, but anyway, so yes, that should be a lot of fun though. I'm not prepared with the dates. I believe it's all 3 days. I think we're going to be there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in the store, that whatever the dates are that following weekend. So, you guys check that out. You just go to Smoky Mountain Knife Works and, on their website, and they probably already got the details up there. And there will be, you know, of course, I want you to come see us, but there's going to be reps from probably most of the other major manufacturers there as well. So it's a really good thing. If you're within driving distance of there, then, you know, it's always a good idea to go in Smoky Mountain Knife Works. It's like freaking Disneyland for knife freaks. So this is the perfect time to go when there's going to be, you know, dealer reps there, so that you can actually get to talk to people that, you know, normally wouldn't be there. So, yeah. So highly encourage you to come out and do that. That should be a good time. This will be the first time we've ever done it. So I'm pretty jacked about it.
Sweet. Yeah. So might have to see if I can make my way up to, it's been a while since I've been to the mountains.
Yeah. And it's, that's a reasonable drive. Anybody over here kind of in the Southeast, you know, not too bad of a drive from pretty much anywhere in the Southeast. I think that's got that wrapped up, the upcoming events for the moment.
I was moving on into my next little dealio, and in case, well, some of y'all might not have noticed, but I have started to notice that there are these things falling out of trees that are turning different colors than green, and there are rumblings, and you know, it's getting a little cooler outside in the morning and stuff, and so I believe that means deer season is approaching. And
yes, it is.
Well, I have hunted. I've never it just, I guess the bug never bit me like it does other people. I know it certainly bit you, for example.
Oh yeah. Yeah. For pretty much my whole life, I've been cursed maybe with the hunting bug. So yeah, definitely. Now I will say for the past, honestly, as the business has grown, my hunting has shrunk because I just,
all my hobbies have. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just the way it goes. But I will say though, that over the last couple of years, you know, I've been able to, partly because when we moved on, it's been more than a couple of years now that we've been in the new shop, but where we moved the new shop to is basically right in the middle of where I hunted anyway. So I'm a lot closer than I was before when we were in the small shop. So, it has allowed me to hunt a little more than I used to, because I don't have an hour each way to drive that ends up being wasted. It's just, I'd always find myself sitting in a tree or a shooting house and like, you know, if I'm seeing something, it's not a big deal. I'm so excited that, like, you know, I'm not worried about it. But if I'm sitting there and I'm not seeing anything, and I'm like, man, I really need to get those, you know, I've got those knives that I really need to finish up, or I've got that program I need to work on, you know what I mean? So it's hard to force myself to sit there when I've got work that I know I could be doing. But I did have a lot of fun. Last year I hunted a pretty fair amount, had a lot of fun with that. And planning on it this year already. Actually, I told Chase before we started, I actually was just in the woods a couple hours ago putting out some corn in front of my cameras, trying to get a idea of what we've got lurking around this year, and already got my eye on a couple of pretty decent ones. So,
I guess that's why it's kind of in my head. My stepdad's been going down to his hunting club, getting everything ready, putting out deer, putting out corn, and, you know, setting up cameras and, you know, making sure everything's, you know, getting his camper back in order and all that. And my neighbors behind me have been putting out corn and stuff, and, like, you know, just kind of preparing. And I've also been working on a few of my hunter pattern. And so, you know, me being, you know, equating everything to knives, basically I had the idea of sort of asking you, or, you know, sort of putting it out there of what to look for in a hunting knife. Cause like I said, I've dressed deer, not ones that I've shot, but I've helped, I guess, dress deer, and, you know, I've done some of that stuff, and I've, you know, I've killed a few animals and field dressed them and stuff, but not nearly to the extent as some other people. And I know like what a good hunting knife is, but I feel like you're more qualified to speak on that subject than me. So.
Yeah. I've definitely gotten my hands dirty more than a couple of times with field dressing, and I've done, field dressing all the way up to, and to be honest, most of the time at this point, like, we've got a really good processor here locally, and I usually field dress them and then take them to the processor for everything else. But I have, you know, broken them completely down, you know, completely processed them myself too. So yeah, I've done a little bit of everything with it. And so I think first, to get into this discussion, we need to talk about, it's a pretty vague term to say what makes a good hunting knife, right?
Yes.
It really all depends. It's just like we say with everything else. It depends on what you actually are planning on doing with it, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, for some people, the way they hunt, they're going out, you know, backpacking in to places and camping and, you know, being in the woods for days at a time, you know, maybe spot and stalk kind of stuff, where they're, you know, they need to be light and, you know, light and nimble, versus somebody that's, you know, parking and walking 50 yards to go sit in a shooting house or
a tree stand
or something like that. Completely different scenarios as far as what you could potentially need. So, you know, in the first scenario where you're going in, you may want to, if you're trying to keep it light, which you probably are because you're not trying to haul, you know, tons of weight in to pack in and camp and hunt from a base camp or whatever. So, you know, you're probably going to want a knife that's kind of like a good do it all, you know, that you can maybe use for some setting up camp, you know, some more like almost bushcraft kind of stuff, you know, maybe splitting some firewood, stuff like that. But then you also want it to be able to do double duty as a, you know, a skinning knife, or even to break them down, again, depending on how you're going to get the animal out of there. So there's a lot of variables there, versus somebody that does like what I said, where I'm, you know, pretty much everywhere I hunt, I mean, there's definitely a chance that, you know, I may have to pull them up out of a really deep bottom or something, but like the bottom of a ridge or something. But like most of the places that I'm hunting are not very far off a trail that I can get to them with a side by side. Right. So yeah. I'm looking at basically, you know, and most of the time, if I can avoid it, I don't even actually field dress them where I shoot them. I usually get them out of the woods, take them somewhere. So I'm not attracting coyotes to the area or whatever, and take them somewhere else and field dress them. And then take them to the processor or whatever. Sometimes it's on the spot. It just depends. But, so again, different requirements for that, because to me in that situation, you know, weight and stuff like that really doesn't factor in. So, but at the same time, the person that's packed in somewhere and they've got to pack the animal out, some of them may be just field dressing them and carry them out that way. But I know a lot of the people also like break them down, you know, break them down into hindquarters and manageable size pieces of meat and pack that up in their backpacks and haul that out. So in that case, you want to make sure you've got a knife that can handle all of that and not just the skinning. And so there's a lot of different variables. And then also, you know, thinking about, do you want to factor in whether you have something that's going to help you, kind of like the people packing in. Well, in any scenario, you could potentially get stranded in the woods or something, even in the less remote situations like I was describing. There's always the potential that something could happen and you might need your knife for more of a survival kind of thing. So like, so all that to say, there's a lot of variables there. So I'd say let's start with just basically field dressing a deer. All right. So to me, field dressing a deer does not require a very big knife at all. Like I have actually done it with one of my little PSK models, which is a lot of you are probably not familiar with because I haven't, that was back in the custom days. I think they had maybe a 2 3/4 inch blade, maybe. Something like that. Something like that. Pretty small, 3 inch or under blade. 3 inch. Yeah, for sure. The only disadvantage I would say that gave me on field dressing one was just because of the shorter blade length, and without getting too graphic here, when you're reaching up inside the animal to cut stuff loose, obviously the shorter the blade is, the farther you've got to actually reach up in there with your hand and arm. So a little bit longer blade is, you know, probably preferable, but you for sure can do it with even a small blade like that. I mean, it will do everything that you need to do to field dress a deer for sure. And I would, you know, probably the same thing with an elk. You get in something that size. The only place I can see you can run into problem, and I was able to do it with the PSK, but if you need to kind of cut through the breastbone to open it on up, then that for something like an elk, you're probably looking at a saw. I've never field dressed an elk, so can't claim to be an expert on that. I'm guessing that's probably more of a saw kind of task than a knife anyway, even a big knife. So you don't necessarily need a big knife. Now, that being said, I prefer one that's, you know, a little bit bigger than that, probably a blade somewhere in the 4 inch range or so. And to be completely honest, you know, the Ridge Runner that we make is that I designed that for me to be basically the best all-around whitetail hunting knife that I could figure out how to make, right? Yeah. So I've got one laying here. So I want to say, I think, what's the blade length on these? I think they're like 4 inches, something like that. Hold on. I think I've got a tape measure. Here we go. Which, and again, this is, I've tried it. I've actually used it. Yeah, just under 4, like 3 1/4 actual cutting edge. So, got these are flat ground. We're probably going to end up doing some in hollow grind too, and I'll have to let you know which one I prefer. I feel like I'm probably going to prefer the hollow grind, but flat grind is not bad, especially if it's a higher flat grind like these are. Yeah. You definitely want something that's going to slice good. Edge retention is important because when you're cutting through hide, it tends to dull a knife quickly, especially if it's usually got dirt and stuff mixed in with it. And it's going to dull the edge pretty quickly if you don't have pretty good edge retention. So this one, my personal one, is made out of 3B, which is good. It holds up pretty well. The good combination between that and the toughness. Or again, if you hit a rib, or like I said, I like to take it and kind of power drive it through the breastbone to open the chest cavity on up. Yeah. And this, you can certainly do that without worrying about it chipping out and stuff with 3B. MagnaCut would be another, obviously, an awesome choice. Might even be a little better on the edge retention side of things. So size-wise, that's, I'd say, somewhere in that 3.5 to 4.5 range is probably would be my ideal. It's not so big that it's bulky and you're not going to want to carry it on your belt or whatever. And it's not, I mean, you just don't need more knife than that to field dress a deer, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think that's sort of the generally sort of agreed upon consensus, is somewhere 3.5 to 4 inches is about, you know, like, but once you start getting up over 4 inches, you know, you're more into the quote unquote survival or tactical arena, more so than just simply a hunting, skinning, you know, type of knife.
Yeah, or using it, like I said, survival, or like, you know, those people that are camping in or whatever, you know, you most certainly can still do all those same things with a bigger knife if you want the bigger knife to be able to also, you know, baton through some firewood or stuff like that. So, you know, in that case, again, that's not really, I've never really done that style of hunting, but I can imagine that you would probably want to maybe step up the size a little bigger, maybe something like in the 4 to 5 inch range. Maybe even 6 inch if you're really, you know, going to be dependent on it for firewood and stuff like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, and there's, you know, people that live still in, you know, jungles and stuff. I mean, they use a machete for everything from, you know, chopping vegetables to, you know, skinning to cutting down, you know, things. Like, the machete is the one tool, and it's a, you know, a big knife can still do small tasks too.
That's right. It may not be ideal, but you can. Yep. You can typically make it work, and sometimes more so than the other way around, than having something that's too small that maybe can't do some of the tasks that a machete can do very efficiently. So another thing to talk about is the shape of the blade.
And I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. So again, there's different, it depends on whether you're wanting like an all around or whether you're wanting specific stuff. All right. Because I know everybody's seen Skinners, right? A Skinner typically has got way more belly. It's not nearly as pointy. And for skinning, those are fantastic. That would be my preferred go-to blade shape strictly for skinning, right? But if you're fully, so in other words, if you've got the luxury of maybe having a couple of knives, ideally, if I was going to have, you know, the perfect tool for each job, I would probably have something more like the Ridge Runner here that's a little pointier, and like a skinning knife that's got more belly and less point for skinning and trying to get it skinned and opened up without puncturing things that you don't want to puncture, then that's where a skinning knife comes in really handy. But I personally, I mean, I'm a knife freak, but I don't necessarily want to carry two knives into the woods with me. So that may be sacrilege maybe I should be wanting to carry all the knives, but you know, I'm human and I don't want to be weighted down with a bunch of stuff either. Every time I'm going to the woods, I already carry enough crap with me. So, probably most of which I don't need, but anyway,
One point I want to make real quick, just for anybody who doesn't know, I mean, this is the Knife Freak Show, but maybe you're new, maybe you're not familiar with the terms, but when he's talking about belly, that's basically the curved portion of the blade. Yeah. Like any,
I'm showing, I know you can't see me, Chase, but I'm showing it on the Ridge Runner. So. Yeah, the curve.
I'm showing knives over here too. So
okay, good deal.
But so the belly is what, you know, typically you want for that sort of skinning purpose. But when he says that just means the curvature of the blade. So continue. Yeah.
And like I said, typically if something has a big deep belly, it comes up to less of a point. Like the belly kind of rounds up more to the point, and so it doesn't have a real stabby point to it. So
that's a technical term, by the way.
All right. So for a but for a like general purpose, like I wanted to do when I designed the Ridge Runner. So what I wanted was I wanted more point, so that, because there are things depending on, again, on how you field dress, what you're field dressing, there are places where you need to actually be able to kind of stab in and work your way around. I won't get too graphic with it, but there are times when you want a point on there, and then still have enough belly to be able to get the job done skinning and not so super pointy that you can't, like I said, you can't open up without getting into stuff and puncturing stuff that you don't want to. So yeah. That's, as far as the blade goes, that's my preference for an all around hunting knife, would be something, you know, like a drop point that has fair amount of point to it, but also a fair amount of belly, kind of a good balance between those two is kind of my ideal for that.
Have you ever used like an upswept, sort of like a, like the old timer, sharp finger type?
Like a Persian almost, yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if I've ever used either that old timer, the straight sharp finger, or if I've ever used one of the couple that I've made similar to that.
Cause I know that used to be more in vogue, of that being mm-hmm. sort of a hunting style knife with the large belly.
Upswept. Yeah. Which does kind of give you the same thing I was talking about. It's almost a little more extreme version of what I was talking about, where you've got belly, but then you've also got the sharp tip that you can use for puncturing things where you need to puncture stuff. So, I can't remember. I know I've used one like that, field dressing a turkey before, but I can't remember if I ever actually did with on a deer or not. I think I would still personally prefer, you know, a little less extreme and just a good drop point with a decent tip and a decent belly. But, you know, to each his own on that. That's, I definitely wouldn't, you know.
Yeah, I was just curious because I've heard that style was a lot more popular, like, pre-70s, pre-Loveless era, back when most things were forged and the stock removal method wasn't as popular, mm-hmm. that sort of upswept tip that you kind of get naturally from forging. Mm-hmm. And so I was just curious while we were on the subject of blade shapes.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know if that was something that was by design, you know, because of the end use, or if it was more to do with something about the manufacturing side of it that made it easier to produce them like that or whatever. But I definitely wouldn't argue with somebody that said that they like to, you know, use a blade shape like that for cleaning a deer, because that's, I mean, it would certainly work fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, while we're there and while you said something about it also, on the manufacturing side, I would say that an upswept tip would be, I guess, less cost efficient than a forging method of making an upswept tip like that, because of the way we buy steel, you know, even if you're talking about in terms of nesting it in a water jet sheet, it's going to take up more steel because of that high sweep, high bend. Yeah. That's a lot of footprint area, I guess, compared to a traditional drop point or clip point or something like that.
Yeah. If it's a very aggressive upswept tip, then you would probably end up with a little more waste in your steel, less, I would think. So
less yield out of a sheet, or less yield out of a bar. In my case, if I were to make something like that, I'd probably have to buy a wider bar than I typically buy to be able to fit that blade shape in there.
That's right. So I don't think there's anything wrong with those. My personal preference just tends to be more straightforward, just a nice, you know, kind of in between drop point, not too, but now you'll notice that the drop point on the, if I can find the camera, drop point on the Ridge Runner is a little, still probably a little pointier, stabbier than some of the Loveless drop point designs like you were talking about. They probably, they lean a little more towards the more belly, less point. And I kind of went the other way with it because again, there's, at least with the way I clean deer, there's a time and a place for needing something that's going to be kind of stabby and puncture good. So that was why I leaned that way.
Gotcha.
But And I would say for, you know, to kind of round out the discussion on at least the blade side of things, the I do like having some jimping on there because, you know, again, you're going to be working on, your hands are going to get slick and sticky, both kind of at the same time. So yeah. having something that will help you hold on to it is good. Having a good guard or choil or something to make sure that you're on the work, you know, the dangerous side of it, that your finger can't slip off for those same reasons. It's your hands slick. You don't want to be, you don't want your hands sliding up there. So I would say some sort of a way to hold on to it. Well, you know, if it's not a full on actual guard or a choil or whatever, but something that secures your hand in place well, so that you're not worried about your fingers slipping up on the edge of the blade. So
yeah, so like my Mudlark that I'm showing on screen now, like it just goes from handle to sharpened blade. There's not like a self guard. There's not a single finger choil with like a, you know, a traditional Ricasso or anything like that that's blocking. So I wouldn't necessarily think this would be preferable for skinning. Yeah. I mean, it does have the blade shape. It does have all that. And I'm sure it would work in the hands of a skilled person, but it does, you know, not really provide that slippery, you know, defense, I guess, or that extra little bit of sliding up on the blade.
A little bit of extra safety and just, you know, confidence in knowing that you're, because again, sometimes you're reaching up inside the chest cavity kind of blindly, you know, cutting away at stuff. Like it's nice to know that your hand's not going to go anywhere and you're not going to come back with a, you know, a mix of the deer's blood and your blood both on your hand. So
there's already blood everywhere. You don't want to open the path to yours in that mix.
No, for sure. Yeah. I would prefer not to. And the last thing I would say would be on the, like, kind of a combination of like blade thickness and the grinds. We already kind of mentioned the grinds. And some of this factors into the blade steel, just like we've talked about before in discussions about ideal blade steels and all the different factors that factor into that. But I prefer something that has a decent size blade thickness to it. The blade stock, you know, at least something, I would say at least 1/8 of an inch. Now the argument could be made that you could probably go a little thinner than that and be fine, especially depending on the length of the blade. If you're working on one that's a little bit shorter blade, you could probably get by with a little bit thinner, but I like mine to be just a little bit more on the beefy side. So I think these come in, I think the Ridge Runners come in at like 130 or 135. I can't remember for sure. I should probably know that. But not super beefy. It's not like a big 1/4 inch stock or anything, but I'm definitely not worried about snapping this thing off with anything I'd be doing cleaning a deer. But then also making sure that the grind is done, you know, in this case, since it's a flat grind, it's done high enough and taken down to thin enough at the edge, which goes back to the discussions we've had before about the blade steel choices and the heat treat choices, and making sure that you've got, that you can take the edge thin enough to make a really good working edge without sacrificing strength and stuff like that. So, because you certainly don't want your edge chipping out on you while you're out there in the field trying to dress something. So the combination of choosing blade thickness, blade grind, the heat treat and stuff, obviously, which again, we've discussed that pretty in depth as far as, generally the trade-offs back and forth with that. So I want something that's heat treated, that's got as good of edge retention, as good of, toughness and chip resistance as possible would be my two biggest, things I would look for as far as like the heat treat and the edge geometry. I think that pretty much describes everything I can think of about the blade. And again, some of this is just personal preference, guys. Like some people might prefer to do everything with a more upswept or a more bigger belly skinning blade or whatever. There's more than one way to skin a deer, literally.
Indeed.
So there's,
and I mean, on that same token, I mean, if it had to be done, I think you could do it. I think you could do it with a McBee. I don't think I could do it. I mean, I could do it. I would make a mess of things, but you know.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Oh yeah. I could literally break an entire deer down with a McBee if it came down to it. I mean, especially when it comes to, when it comes to, you know, the joints and stuff like that, there's ways to, you know, essentially disassemble it without having to like saw through stuff and do all that kind of stuff. So yeah. But if we're talking about kind of ideals, this is like I said, pretty close to what I consider an ideal, at least for whitetail size game knife. So, moving on to the handle, nothing super specific. Again, different people have different tastes when it comes to the handle and stuff. So my main things would be to say, back to like we were talking about the guard and stuff, something you can hold on to, right? Something that's not going to become a safety hazard. So you want something that's got a decent amount of grip to it. It doesn't necessarily have to be textured. It doesn't necessarily have to be contoured, but something that's going to hold up to, you know, a good grip, and you're not going to worry about, again, your hands slipping around on it while you're doing the literal dirty work. I prefer the flip side of that would be also preferably you don't want it giving you hot spots and stuff, because this is going to be one of those kind of tasks where you actually are probably using a knife more than 90% of the things that most of us use them for on a daily basis. You know what I mean? You're going to be bearing down harder on some of the stuff. You're going to be, you know, using it probably longer than you do longer than it takes to open up a couple of Amazon packages or even break down a few boxes. Yeah. So making sure the handle is comfortable to me is, you know, safety first, making sure that you can get a good grip on it. You're not worried about your hands sliding around, and then, comfort as far as hot spots and stuff like that, which is where honestly, one of the things that I think in retrospect has turned a few people off to the Ridge Runner is because the handles look a little weird to them because of these scallops. But honestly, all it is a, get on specific to the Ridge Runner here, but like all it is basically the classic Coke bottle silhouette, right? Yeah. That's just to do it. You know, it's a little less, usually if I do it by hand, it's a little more blended at the edges of these scallops or whatever, but it's essentially the same kind of profile that I would put on it when I would do them by hand. It just looks a little bit different because it's done on a CNC and it's a little more kind of less blended. But as far as comfort, I cannot tell you how many people, when they actually pick one of these up and grab it and they're like, the light bulb goes off. It's like, oh, that feels really good. It's like, it's one of those, you kind of got to feel it to appreciate it. But anyway, that's specific to the Ridge Runner, but goes back to what I was saying about the handle needs to be comfortable and easy to hold on to. Something I can't really picture a reason why you would need it for cleaning a deer, but if for whatever reason you did on the Ridge Runner also, this is not something I would say is a requirement for a good deer hunting knife, but we left the handles on this are shadow boxed. And so it's not really like a skull crusher kind of deal, but it does have an exposed tang right here. So if you needed to, you know, try to crack something or hammer something with that, again, I can't picture why you would be doing that cleaning a deer. But if you get tired and, you know, before you clean the deer, you want to crack open some walnuts or whatever, so you have the energy to clean it. Well, there you go. You can use the butt to bust them open with. That I feel like pretty much covers actually using it. The last thing I would say would be something that's going to, the handles in particular, something that's not going to be too difficult to clean up.
Yeah.
So I like G10. It's not going to soak up the juices. Even Micarta, I would probably steer towards G10 before I would Micarta, just because Micarta is more porous. It's going to tend to soak stuff up more, as cool as a material as it is. And as much as I like it, for realistic, something I can bring back and run under the faucet and clean up, I'd take G10. Carbon fiber would also be fine. It's not, if you want something that looks a little more high speed, it's not going to soak up stuff like Micarta or something would. I'm sure there's things you could do with Micarta, use some kind of sealer on it or something like that. Even just keeping like some blade wax on it would probably pretty much protect it. But my preference would be something less porous like G10 or carbon fiber. What do you think about that?
I would agree. I think it depends on how you treat the carbon fiber or the Micarta as well, or the G10. Because, I mean, if you blast, you know, if it's a blasted G10 handle and, you know, it's some of those lighter color G10s, I imagine it might stain it, but I don't know.
I haven't noticed it. I've actually I've actually cleaned deer with this very knife. So, I don't see any stains or anything.
Is it the slate blue?
No, this is a, yeah, sorry, you can't see it. It's a coyote brown. So it's coyote kind of brown. A lighter color. Yeah. It's like a light tan kind of color.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, my card is definitely, I mean, it's canvas and linen and, you know, burlap and it's cloth. So, I mean, it will soak up stuff, I think, more readily than glass, you know, fiberglass sheets or whatever G10's made out of. But yeah, I would basically agree that any of the handle materials that, you know, are commonly used and stuff are probably good.
Yeah, they're all going to be fine. And it's not like it's going to hurt your micarta. It just most people probably don't want to think about there being blood and stuff soaked into their micarta handle. That, you know what I mean?
So I think polishing micarta would kind of close some of those pores, but I don't know.
It would. The more polished it is, the better it would be. And like I said, even, you know, keeping it coated with wax or something like that would help as well. But that's fairly minor. It certainly would not disqualify a knife for me of being a good hunting knife for sure. My personal preference would probably be G10. I just, for stuff like that, it's hard to beat G10. You can take it off, wash it, you know, take a toothbrush and some, you know, dish detergent or whatever and scrub it if it is a little stained. And the other thing that I would say that's definitely not a requirement, but that is nice, is to have detachable scales like we have on the Ridge Runner, because inevitably you're going to get gunk packed down into like the holes around the hardware, stuff like that, around the edges of the tang and stuff. So it's really nice to be able to pop it off of there, clean it up really good, let it get good and dry, and then put it back together. And then it's totally, you know, back to brand new essentially. So that being said, I don't think I've ever taken mine off, and you probably already knew this was coming. I don't think I've ever actually done that to mine, but for people that are more into, you know, being more meticulous with their gear, then that is a plus, I feel like.
Sure, if you say so.
It's not a requirement by any means.
No,
it's just
no,
one
it's
of those things
not.
That's kind of nice to be able to, you know, because again, like it is, you know, you're going to get stuff packed down in around the, and sure, you could get it out without taking the handle off, but when you can just take out three screws or however many, you know, in this case, three screws, take everything completely apart, clean it really good inside and out, and then oil it, dry it, put it back together or whatever. So, but
no, I see what's happening. You're hating on micarta. You're hating on epoxied on handles. I see what's happening.
Keep in mind, I can't even see what you're showing. So
nothing, but I just, I use mostly micarta and I do not do removable scales because,
Well, and I very rarely did.
Well, that's a manufacturer preference for me. I understand the appeal of it as a customer and, you know, being able to take the scales off, and I've got knives that I've bought that have removable scales and I like them just fine. It's just as the person making it, I definitely prefer epoxied on handles because they don't move. They don't wiggle. They don't misalign themselves overnight.
Yeah.
They don't do any of that. They stay where they are because I glued them in place.
There's definitely some positives to it. And by that same note too, like, you know, I could see the advantage, you know, if you have one like this, because there's not actually a seal, you know, there's not epoxy between the scale and the handle and the metal. So liquids are going to make their way in there. I mean, that's not an airtight seal around this thing. So if you don't take it apart and clean it over time, stuff will seep in there. Whereas with the build that you're talking about, if it's totally sealed up with micarta, it's not going, or with a epoxy, it's not getting past that epoxy. So you basically create a seal all the way. You know, the tang where it's exposed is the only thing getting exposed to any of the elements. So I could see that
to be clear,
potentially an advantage.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not arguing with you. You just felt like you were attacking me for a moment, so.
No, I mean, I use micarta and stuff too. I love micarta, and I've done tons of stuff glued on. And honestly, like you said, the biggest reason we do them screwed on now is the manufacturing side of it and the fact of being able to provide people with aftermarket scales so they can change them around. So it's just, it's almost more like a different business model than it is an actual like technical decision. But
100%. To make removable scales the way I do it would basically be, you know, the scales that started on the knife would become unusable by the time I put the second set of scales on them, because I'm not doing them with a CNC. I actually grind them flush with the tang of the blade. So that's not like a service I can reasonably offer. So I just figured, but if they're not going to move, make them not move.
same thing I did basically when I think I maybe made just a small handful that had removable scales as custom, but it, almost all of them were for sure, glue on. So no, not hating on them, just, and there's pros and cons to either one. If you, like I said, if you're going to be okay with taking it apart and cleaning it, I see that kind of as an advantage. But if you're the kind like me that's not probably going to take it apart and clean it too often, then you might be better off with them glued on, so stuff's not getting up under there places that you don't want it. So, but either way, something that's not too hard to clean.
I agree. And well, that sort of leads me to a question that I think we had about blade finishes. Did you want to try to?
Yes. Yeah, let's wrap up with that. Let me get the I want to pull it up so I can give credit. Let's see. Get the question right. All right, this was Mr. T. Shane on Instagram. Hit me up. I have posted a little thing in my story about questions, and he said he wants to know if there's benefits to blade finishes such as a stonewash, satin, mirrored, or are they generally just cosmetic? For DLC and Cerakote, is there a measurable difference in corrosion resistance, and is it worth the price difference? Do different finishes have an effect on cut performance? Yeah. So do you want to start us off on, like, just say the, like, tumbled satin polished, let's leave the coatings to kind of the second half, and what do you think about the normal, typical blade finishes that are not applying a coating to it?
Typically, like, if we're talking about corrosion resistance in terms of, like, for a hunting knife, I mean, as far as anything that actually affects the cutting, the only one that I would know of that would be hindering to that process is powder coat, which I don't think people really use powder coat much anymore for coating blades, because it generates significant thickness onto the actual, you know, material. Like, it actually adds a layer that's pretty thick. Well, I guess SE does, and SE are good knives. I'm not hating on that, but like, that would be the only one I would say would create more friction within the cut. DLC, PPD, Cerakote, I think they're all thin enough where they wouldn't matter. But
agreed.
Talking about, like, your standard satin, your satin stonewash, your tumbled, even up to mirror, I mean, any of those are going to be, you know, perfectly fine as far as for the cutting performance. They shouldn't affect anything. But for stain resistance, I would say, well, mirror is probably going to be your most corrosion resistant, just because it's going to basically close up those pores. And there's a word I'm looking for, but I can't think of it. But anyway, it's going to beat up the water basically when it gets on the surface. Satin, I would say satin's probably a little less, like a pure belt satin versus like a satin tumble. I would think a satin.
Yeah, it kind of depends on what you're saying with satin. Also versus like a hand rub satin finish, because hand rub satin finish is definitely falls closer to a polished finish than than like a belt satin finish.
Yeah, I'm talking about like a belt satin. Like a pure belt satin would probably be a little more prone to corrosion versus, you know, especially the mirror. But like when you're thinking about like the satin stonewash, like you do and like I do sometimes, where it's, you know, the silver, you know, it's still a silver ground blade, but it's been tumbling for a bit. I think that process of tumbling kind of
it's polishing. I mean, there's
it's essentially, I mean, polishing.
Tumbling is essentially a polishing operation, so it's you're adding some polishing to it. So the way I would sum it up would be, the more polish, the more corrosion resistance. The less polish, the less corrosion resistance. So, down to, so a straight not that we ever do it, but a straight blasted blade, because blasting opens up the pores in the metal. So a straight blasted blade that does not get tumbled at all afterwards would probably be the worst for corrosion. And then the blasted and tumbled, a shorter tumble. So, like, to be honest, our atomic finish is not a real long tumble after we blast it. It's not the most corrosion resistance there is out there. We made a decision to do that, though, because it is one of the more friendly as far as showing wear. And so there was kind of a trade-off there, because obviously a more polished blade, it doesn't take much to scratch it up. And in my opinion, more our customers are more worried about probably showing wear than they are actual corrosion. So,
yeah, I mean, so, there's trade-offs on all of these, as, you know.
There are, yeah. I agree with you that I don't think any of these finishes that we're talking about are going to really affect the cut very much. Maybe if, like, purely scientifically, probably so little difference that you could actually tell in person. But I think in theory, probably a just straight blasted finish that hasn't been tumbled, again, more the rougher that, you know, and you would probably have to look at it under a microscope to even recognize that it was more a rougher finish or whatever, a more porous finish.
But that also kind of gets back to, like, you know, if it's belt ground at, you know, 50 grit and stops there, you know, if that's the satin grind, that one would probably be more prone to corrosion than, like, a blasted.
Sure, because it's more porous. It's being ground with a heavier grit. You know, essentially the scratches in it are bigger, you know, wider scratches. So it's going
bigger
to be
peaks and valleys.
That's right. So more porous and maybe technically less cutting ability, but again, those you're probably
that's
so minute difference that you probably would never notice it on any of that.
Yeah, that would take a ridiculously expensive lab and test to be able to even suss out those results, and they would be so minuscule, I don't think it would matter.
Yeah, but the corrosion resistance for sure. Essentially, just always think about it as more polished is better corrosion resistance, less polished is less corrosion resistance. So, and again, blasting opens up the pores, makes it less polished, and then the more you tumble it, you know, or if you don't blast it, again, if you leave a satin finish on it, like Chase said, you know, and then you tumble it, that's polishing it some. Or, you know, there's also people that do a full kind of polished finish and then tumble it. So it's almost like a mirror polish, maybe not quite all the way to a mirror, but a pretty high polish, and then tumble it, you know, on top of that, so that you have a good combination of the corrosion resistance and the wear, not resistance, but it doesn't show the wear as much, because it's the tumbling essentially puts a bunch of tiny scratches on it, and so little scratches you put on it don't show up as much. I wouldn't call it resistance, they just don't show as well.
I was trying to think of a term for that.
It's more just that it hides it better. It doesn't keep you from scratching it. It just blends in with the scratches that are already there,
the wear hiding-ness.
That would be my, I think that's pretty cut and dried as far as the finishes, as far as it just a matter of, and we all, you know, some of different companies have different names for stuff, you know, and like Chase said, a belt satin finish, you know, that could leave a pretty wide variety there too. You know, like I said, a belt satin finish at 50 grit versus a belt satin finish at 400 grit are two completely different animals. So it will just kind of depend. And that's where, you know, if you have any questions about this stuff, you know, from a maker or a company, just, you know, ask them a little more about their process and what they're doing with it. And that will kind of tell you, now that you know what you're looking at, you know, how it affects it, then you can just do the research to see what the finish actually is that you're looking at. And you can kind of judge from there what kind of stain resistance and stuff that you would have, and know that it's probably not going to affect the cutting ability.
Yeah. Was part of the question, like, about, like, which finish is better in general, or am I remembering?
No, I don't think so much. Was it just cosmetic differences, and was there an actual difference in the one? Was the part of it was it worth the price difference? And that of course goes back to what you deem important in the knife that you're buying. You know, if you're wanting something, you know, obviously to get a more polished finish takes more time. Like that's, you don't, you know, it starts unpolished and there's a lot of work that goes into making it highly polished. So it just kind of depends on, you know, so it makes sense that there would be more costs involved. So it just depends on what you value in your blade. Like I said, if you're looking for something that's just not going to show a bunch of scratches, and have decent corrosion resistance, then something like our atomic finish, you know, or if you're looking for something that's more highly corrosion resistant, then something like a high satin polished finish, or even a fully like mirror polished finish. Those things are probably going to cost you a little more. And, you know, is it worth it? Well, that's up to you and what you value, you know, more as far as what you want the knife to do. So, you know, that kind of comes down to a personal opinion. The last thing, you kind of touched on it already, though, would be the coatings and the common, like the ones he mentioned were the typical ones that are used nowadays on most knives. Like I said, there are some that still use like powder coat, but most of them are either Cerakote, PVD, or DLC. And I'm not an expert on all these coatings. I've definitely used Cerakote some, and like Chase said, and I'm confident the other ones are the same way. They're very, very thin. It's one of the reasons that people use them on guns, because you can actually Cerakote stuff without it interfering with the action typically. And so it does not take a very thick coating at all to have good coverage. And so they are typically not really going to affect the cutting ability or anything like that. And any of these finishes that are fully intact. So if you've got a Cerakote finish and you don't have, you know, places where it's, you know, worn through or whatever, whether it's Cerakote, PVD or whatever, you're not going to have corrosion on that. Like it's keeping the elements off of the blade. Now the edge on all of them, the actual cutting edge, the secondary bevel for the cutting edge obviously does not have a coating on it. It's been removed and sharpening. Yep. So now that's a different story, but any of the surface that's actually coated, if it's fully coated and not worn through, you shouldn't be getting any corrosion on the surface with any of these coatings, because they're completely separating the metal from the corrosive environment. So that should never be a factor. But yeah, and my understanding with a little bit I know about PVD and DLC is that DLC is technically a form of PVD. So all DLC is technically PVD, but not all PVD is DLC. Okay. That's the way it was explained to me. I'm not an expert on it, so some of you guys, you know, don't light me up if I'm wrong, but that was the way I was told and understood it.
Okay.
But with
that process, it actually like bonds to the material somehow, right? It's like a...
Yeah, my understanding is it's somehow some kind of almost like an electrochemical bond or something.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, like Cerakote, it's essentially just a ceramic-based paint.
Yeah.
And it's literally like a paint, but it's just, I mean, it's not, you know, rattle can paint, obviously, but it's not Krylon. It's a ceramic based paint. And so, and that has to be cured at certain temperatures and stuff. So it's, you know, it's more than just a spray it on and go kind of thing, but there's not any kind of electrical or whatever, you know, I mean, I guess technically paint sticking to a metal surface is a chemical bond or whatever, but it's not quite as complicated as the other coatings. So,
gotcha. You were about to answer my question.
Yeah, I'm fixing to start learning more about some of the PVD and DLC. So
sweet.
We'll see what comes of it. But yeah, that's something I think just because I knew it was something that I had to send off to get done, and it's just always something I've kind of put on the back burner and just, you know, hadn't decided to dive into it, but I am starting to look at it a little bit more now. So take that for what it's worth.
All right. I know you had one other question that you were considering possibly answering. Do you want to do that or not?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I almost forgot which one. Yeah. It's pretty simple. So I had, let me get the name again. This is again kind of a personal. Oh, I'm going to butcher his name, Michael Widower. Maybe I didn't butcher it, Michael. I hope I got it at least close. If not, I apologize. On Instagram, he had asked me about whether we were going to be bringing any new milling patterns to Blade West, and probably not anything newer than the frag. We're going to bring frags. Probably not going to try to squeeze in another different milling pattern between now and then. At least not, I don't know. We may end up working up something special. We're rapidly running out of time, so we'll see. We may end up doing something, but we're probably not going to be doing like our fastback or our shockwave or whatever, or jigged, any of that. But it's not impossible. I may come up with something new to do on a few of them, but probably not a full-blown milling pattern exactly. So that didn't really answer your question, but not any of our traditional milling patterns that we've done on the Mac 2. So we're not going, like I said, not fastbacks or any of those. I might come up with something completely different to do that. We'll see, but
I'm excited to see a shockwave rendition on a Dixon.
Yeah, I think me too.
Be cool.
All of them, I think, after seeing the frag on them, the effect that it has on them by it being 3D essentially because of them being contoured is it takes them to a whole new level with the milling patterns. So yeah, I'm really anxious to see those. We'll see, but yeah, maybe something milled ish for Blade West, but not any of those patterns that we've done previously. Put it that way.
It's a hint.
So. Yeah, and again, that's a big maybe because we're running out of time really quickly. Us getting this new machine in, which was something we had to have, and I'm super happy to have it, but, you know, there's a good bit of time goes into getting a new machine up and running, making pallets, you know, getting the programs on there, all that stuff, and making sure everything's running right, and get it to quit flooding the shop. So, that was kind of bad timing as far as leaving time to get new stuff done before Blade West, but we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, and you only got like 3 weeks, I guess. So,
yeah, it's
looking at the calendar.
It's coming up really quick, which we're in pretty good shape. We've got some stuff set back. Just special project kind of stuff is the only thing that may be questionable. So, well, I think that kind of wraps it up pretty well.
That's what we get.
Yeah, that's right. All right. So, I've been chasing. I've talked about it a little bit. I'm not going to put him on the spot completely here, but we've got a couple of things besides doing the interviews with other people in the industry for the show. I've got at least one other idea we may do to mix the show up. So we'll leave that pretty vague too. Leave you guys scratching your heads. But I think if we're able to do it, I think you guys will really enjoy it. So we'll see. But we'll keep that under our hat just a little bit longer. And I think that should pretty much wrap us up. So we greatly appreciate you guys listening to us. We appreciate the support, appreciate you guys, all the comments and feedback we got on last week's episode. And I feel pretty good about the show when we're able to get somebody as iconic as Ernest Emerson on here. I feel like we're actually making an impression on at least a couple of people. So that's fantastic. So please keep letting us know what you want to hear, you know, questions, ideas, comments, good, bad, or ugly. Yes. We're open to hearing them.
Yeah, and you can either leave those in the comments on YouTube, or I believe Spotify has comments as well, or you can email us to knifefreakshow@gmail.com, and that's knifefreakshow@gmail.com with one S. So any questions, suggestions, knife stories like we've talked about before, future guest ideas, all that sort of stuff, you can find him at McNeeseKnives.com and on Instagram, Facebook, all those places. I'm BoatRideBladeWorks.wixsite.com, BoatRideBladeWorks on Instagram and Facebook. And I believe that's it.
Yep. And we appreciate you guys' support. No, we really appreciate you guys. Without y'all, we'd just be a couple of rednecks sitting here running our mouth. So we appreciate that you're willing to listen. So
for sure.
Thank you guys. I hope you have a fantastic week.
And let your freak flag fly.